I'd first like to say thank you to everyone for joining us for our last event of the semester. I hope you and your families are all doing well in this trying time and that you're in the process of wrapping up your final exams. And finally, this event will have a question and answer period. And if you have questions that you would like Representative Hagedorn to answer, please message me on Zoom using the message function and question. And now, without any further ado, let me introduce our speaker for this event. Representative Jim Hagedorn of Minnesota has been very instrumental in the fight for small businesses and agricultural industries during the epidemic. And he's also met with the vice president and industry leaders in recent weeks to try and combat the spread and effects of COVID-19. And now I'll turn it over to Representative Hagedorn.
Great to be with everyone today. Thanks for the opportunity. I guess these are very interesting times for all of us, but particularly you, going through these last weeks here until you have some sort of a summer break. I don't know how long that's going to last, but I wish you all well. I guess the idea here is just give you a little brief background and then go right to your questions. And so I'm a Republican that represents the first district in Minnesota, which is southern Minnesota. Our district is 21 counties. It's pretty rural, and it's pretty big. It's from the Wisconsin border all the way over to South Dakota, and then Iowa up about 80 miles. The largest city in the district is Rochester, which happens to be home of the Mayo Clinic, one of the more important institutions of medicine in the world, and one of those that's helping lead some of the testing and things like that as far as this COVID-19 is concerned. I was born here in the district. I live in Blue Earth, which was my hometown, and my father years ago was a farmer, so I grew up on a farm. That was a cool thing. We had hogs and we had grain, and my grandfather and father used to work about 1,000 acres back in the 70s and 80s, which was a lot of land back then. It would be the equivalent of working about 10,000 acres today. It was a very good experience and has helped me with my work on the Agriculture Committee. And at some point or another, my father was elected to Congress, and I spent time between the district and Washington, was able to interact with some very interesting people in the Republican Party, President Reagan for one, and then folks like Henry Hyde, who was a leader in the pro-life movement, and Jack Kemp, who eventually ran for vice president, people like that from that area, pretty neat times. I ran for the seat three straight times in 14, 16, 18. Every time we picked up vote, and we just kept going, and there's a few people in history that have done that, including Speaker Newt Gingrich, who ran three times in a row. People don't really realize that, but it took him a while to get to Congress, and he went on to some great things. I don't know about that for me, but I'm just happy to serve, honored to serve. And so in our last election in 18, we won by 1,300 votes. It was a tight race, but it was a very heavily Democrat year. I ran with President Trump. I ran as a conservative. I gave people a clear choice, and that was just enough to get over the finish line. And I was one of only two Republicans in the entire country. Pete Stauber of Minnesota was the other to take back a Democrat seat. It was a tough election for us. We lost about 41 Republican seats, and then we took back two. So I think we overperformed, and we're continuing to try to do that moving into this next election in 2020. We've been working hard. So I serve on the House Agriculture Committee and House Small Business Committee, and they're kind of in the middle of what's going on right now with the coronavirus situation. Obviously, small business has been part of dishing out over $600 billion to small businesses so they can retain employees and try to be in a position when we reopen the economy in these states to get started as efficiently as possible and try to get back our get those unemployment numbers low and get the growth in the economy back. President Trump did a very good job of rebuilding America's economy, getting us to a very strong point. He's going to have to do it all over again. But I'll be one of those that will work with them and try to implement the Republican principles of less regulation, tax reform, energy independence, and things of that nature that are time-tested and proven going back to the Reagan days that can make the difference. So with that, I'm happy to answer your questions and talk about what's going on in the district with this coronavirus or whatever's on your mind. But it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
For sure. Yeah, and thanks for the opportunity. So one question we got is, as a congressman, what does your day-to-day look like? I know the House has not gone back yet, so how do you spend your time?
Yeah, sadly, the House is not back in session. We were supposed to be there this week. Speaker Pelosi decided she wanted to go it alone and basically try to write the bills by herself, which gives her enormous power. she'll call us back to cast a vote or two, but right now she's doing all the negotiating. So I do believe we should be back in Washington. And one other thing on that, Pelosi wants to have remote voting or to have proxy voting. And the reason for that is the Democrats want to play this out as long as possible and try to get to a point where they can justify to the American people having universal registration and then mail-out balloting, which would essentially say that anyone who possibly could vote should be mailed a ballot because it's too dangerous to go to the polls. In Minnesota, we have no excuse absentee balloting, you know, weeks and weeks ahead of time. No excuse in-person balloting ahead of time, I think 3 or 4 weeks. So there's no reason to do that here. There's no reason to do it anywhere. And it would lead to massive voter fraud. So that's what she's up to there. Otherwise, I've actually been quite busy, probably the most busy I've ever been in my entire life. And it has to do with virtually everyone in our society having some sort of problem or another due to this, not just the virus, but the pause in the economy. So we hear from people, obviously, in the medical community who need help with getting protective equipment, for instance. We helped a doctor in Fairmont, Minnesota, who needed protective equipment. I called my friend Mike Lindell, who's the MyPillow guy. He was making masks. And then I called another one of my friends over with Bedford Industries in Worthington, Minnesota, where they make most of the world's twist ties, for instance. They were making shields, and asked them if they could supply those to that Fairmont doctor. That's one example of the types of calls that I would get from the medical people. And then from our farmers, they're dealing with really tough things, because when we had the pause in the economy, the restaurants all shut down. And believe it or not, half the food in this country goes through the restaurants, not at home. You'd think it'd be more at home, but it isn't. And the finer cuts of meat, particularly pork, beef, things like that, are almost exclusively through our restaurants. And when those demand for the finer cuts of pork and beef went through the floor, so did the markets for our cattle and hog farmers. And they've had a tough time, and now the packing plants have been shut down. So I've been working with them on that, trying to get the packing plants up and running. That's another example. And then, of course, on the small business side, virtually every small business, every medium-sized business in this district applied for the Paycheck Protection Program, which was an innovative program put together to essentially allow for businesses to get loans in order to keep their employees paid and also do some operational things for the business. And as long as they took 75% of that money and paid the employees, they'd be able to turn that loan into a grant. And so that's just a way to try to help them bridge the pause in the economy and keep them together. So, lots of Zoom calls, lots of discussions. We've even been doing some campaigning. I was just endorsed by the Republican Party this past week, and we had to do all of that through remote conventions. My wife happens to be the chair of the Republican Party in Minnesota. Her name's Jennifer Carnahan. She put all that together. She's been working very hard. So definitely different times. I'll look forward to when we can get back and do things face to face.
Certainly, certainly. So a question that was submitted is, what did you think about Trump naming the meatpacking industries as essential so workers can go back to work? Because on one hand, you've got a huge problem establishing a food supply, but on the other hand, you have to respect the rights of workers. So what did you think about Trump's decision there?
Of course, we love our workers, we love our livestock farmers, and we certainly need to maintain our food supply, which is a national security issue. Can you imagine walking into the grocery stores day after day and having no food there? I mean, it's you could have pocketful of $100 bills, pocketful of EBT cards, but if there's no food on the shelves, how are you going to feed yourself and your families? So Congressman Emmer of Minnesota, Congressman Stauber, and myself petitioned the president and his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, a former congressman from North Carolina, to invoke the Defense Production Act in order to try to get those packing plants up and running, keep them going. Secretary Sonny Perdue of Agriculture is now in charge of that. And we had a plant in Worthington, Minnesota that went down about 2 weeks ago. JBS owns it. There happened to be a Brazilian company. It was a pork producing plant. They have about 2,700 employees total. And it turned out about 400 of them had the coronavirus. So they shut it down. They cleaned it up. They put in some measures now to try to help have some distancing and things like that, proper hygiene. I think they sprayed the whole plant down with a nanotechnology that when the virus hits it, there are these little miniature pins, like prickly things. and it destroys the virus. It's quite something. Actually, I think that technology is from Rochester, Minnesota, of all places. But so, you know, we're back up and running at JBS, not at full speed. We do respect the rights of the employees, but this has been going on in many places around the country. Greenlee, Colorado, I believe, had a beef packing plant. They shut down, they reopened, they're back to work. In a lot of cases, we think that most of the people that work in the packing plants are getting the virus not from work, where they're already in uniforms and things like that. We think they're bringing it into the plant from at home. And a lot of the people that work in the packing plant industry have sometimes two or three folks that work in packing plants all in the same location. Some of them work in other locations. So, you know, we're concerned about it all. But one of the byproducts of all this, we had to shut down these plants, and about a million hogs backed up in the system, no place to go. And the way that our system of livestock, or our system of agriculture in general, is very efficient. But when it goes a little haywire, it's fragile as heck. And so these million hogs, there's no place to put them. They get too big. They can't even go through the packing plants. And the meat is virtually worthless at that point. So unfortunately, we're going to have to put down just about a million hogs and then not even use the meat, not even put it into the food supply. So it's a really tough deal for the farmers. It's obviously a tough deal for people who care about those animals. And to put that in perspective, a million hogs, they're about 5 feet long, snout to tail. That would be a line from Minnesota down to Louisiana, a line of hogs, single file, and we would just use them. Unfortunately, they would just grow and then they'd be destroyed. So this district happens to be the second largest in the country for pork production and a lot of livestock farming. We've been busy on that.
Mm-hmm. So another question we had was about the government's choice to send checks to individual Americans. And you've touched on this briefly, but the question is, by leapfrogging employers, do you think this could hurt the free market culture and infrastructure that the U.S. has? And are you nervous about the precedent that this program has?
Well, that was part of the COVID relief package that was passed by Congress in late March. And there were several aspects of that. There was money for hospitals. There was money, obviously, for the Paycheck Protection Program for small businesses. There was some money for larger businesses like airlines to keep them going. That's also a national security issue to one point or another. And then we had a couple of other areas. One was direct payments to the people of the United States. That was about $250 billion. Anyone making less than $75,000, a family of four making less than $150,000, could have expected $3,400 from the federal government. And then after that, there was another aspect of it, which was tacking on $600 a week unemployment compensation for people who lost their jobs due to this. So those are two different issues. On the stimulus checks, that wouldn't have been my idea. I know the president and others decided to do it. I'm not second guessing them. I voted for the bill. We didn't really have much choice. You know, we were in the middle of free fall. We had to help people. But I thought a better way to do it would have been to suspend the payroll tax or some other, give payroll tax rebates. Could have done a lot of different things. So it would have rewarded work instead of just rewarded, you know, existing. And I think in the long run, that would have been better. The people before the coronavirus outbreak that were working, obviously, they were going to get either unemployment or they were going to continue to be paid through the Paycheck Protection Program. Those that weren't working were already being covered in some aspect, whether it was welfare or retirement programs or whatever. So I didn't see the need for it. And I really hope we don't do that again. But I understand, you know, the president wanted to see, you know, to make sure everybody was cared for as best as possible. These were good intentions. I just think we should have done it a different way. As far as the unemployment compensation deal, that is a provision that is causing lots of problems with business and creating a disincentive for people to go back to work. It's probably the most liberal bad idea that was in that package. The United States Senate recognized that it was a problem before the bill was passed by the Senate. Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, and also Tim Scott from South Carolina, and several other members, I think Ted Cruz and others, offered an amendment to strip that out. And they said, you know, people are going to get more money not working than working, and that's not going to give them an incentive to go back to work. And so unfortunately, the vote to strip that out was on party lines, 47-47. In the Senate, you need 60 votes in order to pass anything. It's a goofy system over there. We need to change it. So they left it in the bill. It passed. We had to, you know, plug our nose or whatever you say and vote for it. But in actuality, when somebody's called back to work, they're supposed to lose the $600 extra for unemployment. But I don't trust the states like Minnesota, where we have a liberal governor, to administer that properly. So that's a four-month program. We're almost halfway through that. Hopefully that'll end and we can get people back to work.
Mm-hmm. So another question someone had was, how do you see the country reopening? Some have suggested that any sort of national, you know, system or guidelines are too strict. And on the other hand, you've got places like Minnesota that are comparatively doing better. But at the same time, Governor Waltz is very wary about opening Minnesota up. So how do you see our path forward through this pandemic?
You've been following our state a little bit, I see. Okay. Well, you know, it goes down to this. I mean, obviously, we wanted to do everything possible to minimize this outbreak, keep the loss of life to as low a level as possible, and then be in a position to strongly unwind and get the economy going again. There are different ways of looking at this. And one is there are some studies out, including a Wall Street Journal article just this week, saying that, you know, if you targeted to the people who are most vulnerable, for instance, the people in nursing homes, the elderly, people with pre-existing or underlying conditions, you might have been as successful in maintaining, you know, keeping the loss of life to a low level as if you did all this strict stay-at-home stuff. And I think the more information that comes out about what's going on state to state, for instance, South Dakota didn't do a whole lot of the strict stay-at-home type thing, and Minnesota did. You know, Iowa was a little less strict. Sweden, for instance, as a country was less strict. We might see that it doesn't matter. The fact is, in Minnesota, something like 99% of the deaths have been either in nursing homes or people who are elderly or those with underlying conditions. Very few people are being affected by this and passing away if they're relatively healthy. Certainly the younger people are having not as much problems. So, you know, it might be that we should have opened it up a little bit more, let people have more of a herd immunity and not have such a hit against our economy and our way of life. That having been said, I do think it's time to open up. And I've been going after the governor for five straight weeks in one particular area, and that is the hospitals. He set a strategy 5 or 6 weeks ago to virtually shut down our hospitals in Minnesota. And that was based upon estimates that the COVID-19 would take upwards of 70,000 lives in Minnesota. 22,000 was the next level down. Now we're, you know, less than 1,000. And I said, fine, I'm not going to look back and say you did it wrong. I won't. But now that you know there's a difference and there's a new set of estimates, can't we have a new strategy and open up our hospitals? Because what people, not everybody is understanding, is that when you shut down the hospitals and the medical clinics, a lot of people that needed routine care, not just elective surgeries for rotator cuff or knee injuries or whatever, but people that just needed routine care, needed to get to the doctor, needed to be checked out, needed to have the test done. When they put that off a month or two or three, it's going to end up with a lot of unintended consequences. You're going to have people like myself. I was diagnosed with advanced kidney cancer a year ago. I've been getting treatments at the Mayo Clinic for that time. The treatments are going very well. I feel great. I haven't missed any time in Congress, any of that. But I asked my doctor about it, and I said, you know, because I had no symptoms. They found it by accident during a physical. And I said, if somebody was in my situation and had to go a month or two or three before they were diagnosed and treated, what would happen? And he told me that I was at a tipping point a year ago. I probably wouldn't be alive today. There are a lot of people in that circumstance, and also people who have heart conditions that aren't being diagnosed. And sometimes they go to the doctor, and the doctor often would say, hey, I'm glad you're here today, because if you weren't here today, you wouldn't be with us tomorrow. We got to get a stent and clear that stuff out. You know, things with hypertension and strokes, diabetes, there's all sorts of unintended things that are going on. And Sanford Medical here in Southwest Minnesota has come out and said, we're now going to see a surge of other cases, and that's the surge of the people who haven't received routine care, who have been neglected these last 1, 2, or 3 months. And those are the people we're going to have to care about now. And unfortunately, many of them will pass away. and some of them will have terminal conditions, and others will have far more complicated health issues than they otherwise would have.
Certainly. So another question we got is, how do you think that coronavirus will or should have a long-term impact on the U.S.-China relationship?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm someone who actually, even before President Trump was running, was in my campaigns talking about how China is an adversary, not a trading partner. They're an adversary, and we need to start looking at them that way. So I think this just helps to highlight what the president's been doing, to say that we've got to be tough on China, that we needed trade deals that were good for the people of the United States, that we gave way too much away and turned a blind eye when China would steal our technology, force technology transfers, manipulate currency, just outright cheat on their deals. And then, of course, all the shenanigans they're doing around the world. So this is going to change things a lot. Whether the coronavirus came from a wet market, or it was part of a lab over there where they were studying these coronaviruses and bats, whatever they did, however it escaped. And I don't think it was as sinister as to how it got out. But what did they do about it? Did they call us in to say, let's contain it? You know, did they alert the world? No, they covered it up. And they frankly, I mean, they even sent people to the White House in, I think it was January, to sign the phase one China deal. And clearly the president didn't know what was going on, because he wouldn't have invited a bunch of people from China into his office if there was a problem. And they lied about it. They manipulated the world. You had Dr. Fauci on TV in late January and early February. And everybody says, he's the expert. Listen to the expert. Well, he was on TV, national TV, telling people, you know, this isn't going to amount to a whole lot in the United States. I'm not too worried about it for the United States. And he didn't say that because he didn't know what he was talking about. He said that because the Chinese had lied about it. And that's the information he had. And so I think, you know, the World Health Organization, it needs to be reformed. I support the president's position to withhold monies. We've given about $1 billion in the last 2 years to that group. And they're basically run by China. And they're just a disinformation, you know, group that hurt us. It might have killed now 70,000 Americans needlessly. It's possible we could have contained that. So, and then when you move one step further, sorry to be so long-winded on this answer, but one step further with China, it shows again how vulnerable we are in the supply chain. We're worried about getting medicines from China. We're worried about getting protective supplies like masks and shields and gowns from China. We're worried about key components to our economy that if China, you know, shuts it down, what are we going to do? Defense components, things that we rely on for our military, China controls too much of that. And then rare earth materials. China's gone all around the world and basically bought up a bunch of rare earth materials, you know, mines and lots in Africa and other places. And the United States has gone from being completely self-sufficient in these areas to now depending on China, of all places, for the majority of many of these materials, when in places like northern Minnesota, we have all the resources that we need. We just need to go mine for it. But the liberals, the environmental extremists, stand our way all the time. So I think you're going to see China to be a big issue in the campaign. And the Democrats are going to have a tough time. The environmentalists are going to be over on one side. And the union workers are going to be on the other, saying we want our jobs. And then a lot of the people are going to be saying, no, we don't want to depend on China. They're bad guys. And finally, they're seeing it for what it is. So I think President Trump and others have done a terrific job on that issue.
Mm-hmm. So we've had a few questions about your thoughts on the elections in November. How do you see coronavirus influencing, you know, the presidential election? Because Trump's very visible, and even just for conservatives generally.
So 2 months ago, if we had this talk, I'd be talking about, we did have the strongest economy. The president's right. He's not making that up. I mean, it was something incredible. I'm a Reagan guy. I mean, I grew up and worked on Capitol Hill during the Reagan Revolution. He was my political hero for my whole life. But I think this economy that we had before this coronavirus was even stronger and more stable. And I got, you know, it's sad. I'd go across southern Minnesota, talk to businesses. The only thing that they worried about was finding more workers. They had the demand. And, you know, construction companies would tell me, we can do 30% more work if we can just get the workers. We need skilled workforce. So I was working on those issues and others. Even the farmers were upbeat after 5 and 6 years of low commodity prices. And that all started with Obama. It didn't start with President Trump. And then, of course, we did have the trade, back and forth with China and others, but that was all worked out. They were kind of excited again. The trade deal with Canada and Mexico, the trade deal with China and Japan, and a good growing season in front of us. They thought they were turning the corner, and then this all hit. So it is going to be a little different election. The president, we were prepared to run on the strong economy and the achievements we made there. We're just going to have to do it all over again. We're going to have to try and unwind it, put the principles in place, and let the ingenuity and hard work of the American entrepreneur get back at it, and the American workers, and try to have a campaign where moving into the election, people feel good about where we are, that we're in the right direction, that we're rebuilding it, and that President Trump and the Republicans are the best to be in office in order to get that done. On the other issues, it probably diminishes some of them. The Democrats were ready to run on prescription drugs, on healthcare again. I was ready to run on prescription drugs and healthcare because what the Democrats were going to do is make it so we didn't produce as many life-saving cures in the United States, and we would lose between 10 and 100 life-saving cures over the next decade with their liberal bill that Pelosi put out there that would have run our companies out of doing that type of research. And I told everybody knows at least one person in their life. I mean, I'm an example of that, who's alive today because of an incredible biopharmaceutical cure that was developed within the last 10 years in the United States. And everybody knows at least somebody who, if they were diagnosed with cancer or some terrible illness today, they'd be alive and they'd live a full life, except that wasn't available back then and they passed away. So that and the fact that in this district, we have Mayo Clinic, fine rural hospitals. My opponent and other Democrats want to have a public option, which would drive down reimbursements to those hospitals. And anyone who wants to know what it's like when hospitals don't have as much reimbursements can just look back the last 5 and 6 weeks. They furloughed 25,000 employees at the Mayo Clinic. I mean, that city of 115,000 people has 35,000 direct workers at the Mayo Clinic. And hospitals in this district, in and around our cities, are important parts of our economy. So if you want to know what would happen if we lower reimbursements, you're going to have hospitals in the rural areas shutting down. You're going to have people being furloughed and losing salary and losing their jobs, and our economies are going to suffer. So I'm prepared to run on that issue and go after the Democrats on that. And then just the basic contrast. Look, some of these things aren't going to go away. We're for secure borders. We want a strong military. We want to project American values all around the world. That's peace through strength. We want to make sure that we have a strong economy built with free enterprise capitalism and the principles that can make that happen. And then we get into the areas in my district like agriculture, medicine, small business, where I'm there to protect them, support them, do the best. And lastly, our God-given rights. The right to life, the right to keep and bear arms, the right to religious freedom are the three that are most under attack by the left. They are the three that are most in contrast in this election. My opponent is for gun confiscation. He supports abortion through birth. And on top of that, on religious liberty, I don't know. He never talks about it, I talk about it all the time. So there's a big difference. So I think it'll still be a clear contrast election. If you like the president and you like the Republican policies, you're going to vote over there. If you don't, you won't. The people that were for impeachment are still going to be against us. The people that were against impeachment are still for us. That's probably where we are.
So you've talked a bit about the importance of hospitals and new medical treatments. I know you had you were at the very public interaction between Pence and Mayo, but can you tell us anything about anything Mayo might be doing to combat the coronavirus? Any efforts that could potentially bear some fruit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we were just with the vice president a little over a week ago in Rochester at the Mayo Clinic. It was a tour that he had taken to check out their new testing, especially the serology testing and the concept of taking their blood, plasma that has antibodies. It'd be people who had already had the illness. That's what their serology test would show. Take that blood out, kind of mix it around, and then inject it into another person who could have coronavirus and be very much at risk. Try to help them get through the process. It would be something they would use mostly, I think, in the last ditch effort in order to help somebody combat the illness. The vice president's tour was extraordinary. He was well received by the people at the Mayo Clinic. It was an excellent tour, and I think the American people learned a lot about the serology testing there and this plasma trial that Mayo is doing. We have thousands of people across the country giving blood for this trial that have already had coronavirus. So we'll see how it goes. I hope it's successful because that's going to help us to, as an antiviral type thing, get people out in society and know that if they have a problem, there's a mechanism there to try to get them through it. And the big part of the trip was, you know, everybody, the Mayo's policy is you should wear a mask. I wore a mask. Everybody did. Frankly, it's the first time in my life I'd ever worn one. And the vice president was in a separate holding room. And I don't know if he knew about that. He came in and everybody had a mask. I mean, when we arrived at the airport, Secret Service didn't have masks. Vice president, myself, others didn't have a mask. But it's too bad that overshadowed it. Since then, he's been to Indiana and other places and has worn a mask. So I think that's hopefully in the past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So another question I had is, for example, in the state of Minnesota, most of the testing is done by either Mayo Clinic or the University of Minnesota. Do you, and that's not the case in most other states. So do you prefer that approach of, you know, a lot of smaller hospitals or private businesses, you know, enforcing the testing? And do you just think testing is the correct path forward? I know a lot of, you know, politicians have been saying testing is the only way to successfully combat this epidemic.
No, it's not the only way to move forward. If we just relied on testing, nobody would leave their homes for the next 2 years, probably, until we had some sort of vaccine that everyone thought was 100% right. So testing can be important, no doubt. In Minnesota, they've part of the Operation Moonshot or whatever it is that Governor Walz put together. That was another reason we were at Mayo, is to talk about how they're going to be in a position to test upwards of 20,000 people. I think it was a week. I don't think it was a day. I think it was 20,000 a week. And at Mayo would partner with the University of Minnesota and other associations, including, for instance, Sanford Medical down in our district. So, you know, you can go in to the packing plant, for instance, test 2,700 people. Realize that 400 have it. Obviously, the 400 have it. Go and quarantine and get away and, you know, try to stay away from other people for 14 days or so until you can be cleared to come back to work. But, you know, you pretty much have to test every day because the next day somebody could have run into somebody else and gotten the illness or whatever. I mean, saying, you know, we just can't do it. You can't test every day to have people at work. So taking temperatures, looking for symptoms, all those things are important. If there is a breakout, you go in and do your best like they did at the JBS plant in Worthington to get a grip on it and get that thing reopened. We'll do that manufacturing in other areas. But another thing that they found about the testing is that 85% of the people who tested positive for coronavirus down there in Worthington, Minnesota, had no symptoms whatsoever. So they didn't have a runny nose, they didn't have a cough, they didn't have a fever, they had nothing. And so this virus can be transmitted through people that don't have any symptoms. But for about 85% of the people, it appears, based upon that, it doesn't really have much of an effect at all. And so maybe as we learn more about that and learn about who it really does affect, then maybe people will have a little bit more confidence to get out and about and take some, you know, a little bit more risk as far as getting out and shopping and frequenting restaurants and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. So another question we had is when the government is restricting our liberty and individual rights for the sake of some intangible public safety, are you swayed by concerns of the government violating our rights, independent of how virulent the coronavirus might be?
Well, I am swayed by that, particularly in a state like Minnesota, where there was an emergency order that was utilized, that there's some debate as to whether or not the governor has the authority to continue utilizing it. I think he should have had to go back to the legislature and ask them for that authority over, you know, and continue to have that reviewed. There are people in society here today that are getting out and about. Some of them have gone back to their businesses, even though that's not allowed. They're supposed to be selling by curbside. I don't know what that means. How does a small business sell on curbside? I mean, if you don't know what's in the store, how do you know what to buy? It's kind of a goofy thing. And then as far as not being able to go to the hospitals because they were shut down and churches and things of that nature, I think it's over the top. Mostly I'd say give people the best understanding of what's going on that you have. Keep them updated and let them make decisions for themselves as to what's best. And by and large, most of the time, the American people will figure it out. They have common sense. Nobody wants to be in harm's way. Nobody wants to die an untimely death. Nobody wants to take risks that are, you know, over the top. And, but I fear that the government has made too many decisions for us and not given us the ability to do that. There are business owners today, if they were able to open up, would have policies in place that would keep people apart and do what you needed to do until we learn more about what's going on and how many people have had coronavirus to see how impactful it is. And it may turn out, you know, some of these statistics, they say, well, look, there's 100,000 cases and there's 1,000 deaths. And oh, look at that. It's a high death rate, but not necessarily. It's probably likely that for every case that's on the books where somebody is confirmed to have coronavirus at that particular point in time, it's probably the case that 50 or 80 or 100 people have already had it for that one person. And then when you start doing the math calculations, if that were the case, the survival rate would be somewhere in the area of probably 99.9%. And when you factor in the people who are elderly and those in the high risk, if you're not in those categories, the survival rate would be even better. So we're gonna learn a lot more as some of the serology and other testing is out there, and hopefully it'll give people confidence to get out and about, and we can get our country back.
Mm-hmm. So I know you need to get out at 45, so I'll take one last question. And so the question was, in regards to Andrew Cuomo complaining that the federal government can't let New York go bankrupt, even though New York has some of the highest taxes, and kind of that mentality of too big to fail. So
yeah.
On one hand, you know, should the federal government help bail out New York? And on the other hand, how do you try to rail in this spending?
Yeah, I don't support bailing out New York or Illinois or these other liberal states that have mismanaged their operations for many years, had very high taxes, a lot of labor that they didn't need, and all sorts of bureaucracy. So we can't let them utilize this in order to make up for all the problems they've had when other states have done it right and have been managed properly and have kept their taxes low and things of that nature. So, you know, what's being missed by Governor Cuomo and others is that the federal government has already provided states with a lot of money, and through the hospitals and other ways that the states aren't going to have to make that up where they normally would. So I think, and also nutrition programs and unemployment, you go down the line, lots of ways the federal government has already given states lots of money. So I would rather see us focus on what's needed in order to help people get through this pause in the economy, get businesses back up and running. And one of the ways for states to do better is to have some economic activity and to get some revenues in that way. And the ones that it seems like are holding out the most to not open up business and commerce are the ones that say they need more help. And I don't like that either. So this next package will come, it'll be put together probably in the next week or two. Speaker Pelosi has been negotiating with the Republicans in the Senate. The spending bills are supposed to start in the House, so Speaker Pelosi may draft this one herself. After it's drafted up and the Republicans probably uniformly vote against it, the Democrats will pass it. They have the majority in the House. We're going to be able to see a lot about what they value. And I think it's going to make the Democrats look pretty bad when they have all sorts of spending for all sorts of liberal causes and all sorts of their friends, and they forget about the farmers and they forget about the business people, or they just forget about the fiscal discipline, which is important to all of us as we move forward. And then when we get to the Senate, there'll be a compromise there, and I hope it's something that the president and the Senate just stand firm on, and we don't get a lot of excess spending. But this is an episode in our lives that we'll never forget. The people who are graduating from high school and college this year, everybody will know who they are, the class of the coronavirus. And it's a sad deal, because in a matter of 6 weeks, for instance, for some of my pork producer friends, they went from business as usual and not really a worry in the world to the brink of extinction. That's how quick it can change. And so I guess it's a good lesson for all of us to realize that no matter where we are in our life, no matter what dreams we have, no matter how hard we work, got to pay attention to it and hope for the best, because some things can come in and wipe them out pretty quickly. And that's a shame in this case. And my goal is to make sure that no business, no small business, no farmer goes broke and people lose their jobs over this, because it was through no fault of their own. Nobody deserves that. And then we can get back to getting our country together again.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure you're very busy, but thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I feel like we really learned a lot from this conversation.
Well, I appreciate your time. It's nice of you to put this together. I wish everyone well on the call. And if there's something that you think that I can do or any of my colleagues for you, please reach out to me directly. Okay. You know how to contact me, and we're happy to be there. I appreciate the way you stand up for conservative values and for, common sense in our world. And it's good to have younger folks that are going to lead the way coming forward here in the next decade. So I look forward to you being great leaders, and whether it's in business or politics or whatever, and hopefully our paths will cross again sometime in the near future. I would stay with you longer, but I have to get on a conference call with Leader McCarthy and our Republican caucus. We're actually going to talk about agriculture today, and we do this about every other day, but I have to get to that call at noon. So thanks for the opportunity. It's wonderful to be with you.
Yeah, thanks very much.